The legal system is designed to defend the status quo, right, and maintain the status quo. But the status quo is killing us. And so what to do then, right? We have all of these systems, the legal system, you could argue our computational infrastructure. All these systems are sort of grounded in assumptions that come out of the Holocene, right? This sort of era that has passed. I think we need across the board to shift into this new era that we're in, which is one where we need to be thinking about regeneration and limits.
Hello and welcome to the Culture and Technology Podcast, brought to you by the Vienna Business Agency. My name is Severin Matusek, and today's guests are Tiga Brain and Sam Levine. Tiga and Sam are artists, engineers, educators, and frequent collaborators who question the dominant narratives of technology, capitalism, and power structures in order to design alternative systems. Systems that act in harmony with their environments, not against it. To give you an example, Sam and Tiga created a dating service that connects people based on the way they smell. Or they're building a global network of solar-powered computer servers that are only active when the sun is shining. Or they designed a sleeping pod that explores streaming as a potential climate engineering technology. Tiga and Sam are based in New York, but visited Europe last summer to speak at Creative Days Vienna. I was lucky to catch up with them at my studio in Berlin to discuss their work and ideas. Welcome to the Culture and Technology Podcast. I'm very excited to interview both of you because you are frequent collaborators on a lot of the projects that we'll discuss today. So what was the first project you worked on together?
The very, very first one was like this project about where we took like all the material from the Intergovernmental Panel on climate change and changed the word climate change to the word capitalism and then did that to everything that they ever produced, right? But I think, you know,
including video and like their whole YouTube course.
So we did this like find replace across like all media for them. But I think like the sort of the, you know, we the real way that we got to know each other was that we made a dating service together, actually. Yeah. So like at the time, Tiga had this interest in making this sort of smell-based dating service, and I was running a little independent magazine, and I was trying to help people produce projects, and no one would produce this project that Tiga was interested in. Like, she kept getting rejected from galleries and stuff. Short-sighted galleries would reject her, and then I was like, "Oh my god, it's amazing!" And so we made this this dating service together.
How did you get the idea for the dating service? Because it's quite different from, you know, the other project that you've done so far.
Yeah, I mean, it was around 2015, 2016 that we were working on this. And this was a moment where everybody just got fascinated with data visualization. I don't know if you remember. But there were
infographics.
Infographics. There were data viz conferences or everywhere in New York. And so with this in the air, I really started thinking about other forms of information that weren't visual. And namely smell. Like, smell's so interesting because, you know, the science is still unresolved on how the body interprets smell, like how molecules get interpreted by your nose. It's material. It doesn't scale in the same way as software. You know, you get, it's such a more like emotional and sort of memory driven reaction. So I was really interested in like, how do you create interfaces for smell? You know, it resists computation. It's so hard to incorporate that into computational interfaces. So yeah, so just had this idea of like, what would it be like to have a dating service that's based on smell? Obviously, that's like massively important in relationships, but it's not really talked about. And so yeah, the service worked. So we talked to a lot of smell researchers, and smell researchers were like, oh, well, you should just do it like we do pheromone research, like get people to wear T-shirts. That's how we do it in labs. And Sam and I were like, great, let's do that. So we sent out a T-shirt to everybody who signed up. We had over 100 people sign up to the first round in New York City. They asked them to wear a T-shirt for 3 days, preferably without deodorant, so that they're getting the, you know, true information in there. They sent us the shirts back. We cut them up into swatches, and then you would get sent a batch of 10 swatches with no information about gender or age or anything. And you then just elected which swatches, which numbers you wanted to meet, and put them in our system, which was just like an online home for the project. And then our system would match. If it was a mutual match, you would get put in an email and go on a date together. And yeah, so the project was just wildly popular, I think, because it's also a fascinating question, right? Is like, would you make different decisions about who you date if you were going off smell rather than visual information? Obviously, like the profile picture and the way that dating services are so reliant on visual information really is, you know, really difficult and problematic for a lot of people. So yeah, the project just got so much excitement and enthusiasm for that reason, I think.
But I think the other aspect of it that, I mean, so it was really fun and goofy, right? And like ridiculous.
And people actually met and started dating and married, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Tiga ended up blessing a wedding, like giving a blessing. I don't know, just all these funny little, you know, but I just want to like add like this other little thing that I think is a kind of important note, which is that like at the time also like, you know, like Tinder, which, you know, the hugely popular, you know, dating app was getting in, they were in trouble because it had come out that they were like matching people based on race and stuff.
Oh.
Right. So, like, you know, like, I think it's a really important thing to like that this project was, in addition to the goofy, fun aspects of it, was also like responding to this like reality around like dating algorithms, you know?
Right. And because it was a moment when, you know, machine learning was starting to get introduced into digital platforms. And of course, then the story around, oh, well, like people make decisions based on race and gender and these biases that they have. And then this just gets automatically then reflected in how these interfaces and these recommendation engines work. So, yeah, that was definitely something that was being reported on. And I mean, I think this is what we're trying to do in our work is like, through proposing sort of an alternative configuration or an alternative system, also providing then a critique of like what's happening in the mainstream, you know, status quo tech space.
I think smell dating is a great example of how I would categorize your work on a very broad spectrum, because I think that it has this combination of something very analog and physical, which is smell, which, as you said, is very hard to translate into computational language. And at the same time, it has something very digital and scalable and this element of code that I think that Sam often brings in. And I wondered, you know, talking about climate and technology, which is our topic for today, there is somehow this similarity there that I feel like in the general perception, climate crisis we're in is something that most people perceive in a very analog way. Like we feel it when it's extremely hot or extremely cold, and we see it and we hear the news and we have real anxiety. But it's not really reflected in the way we use these digital technologies that surround us everywhere. And I think in a lot of the work that you've done over the last few years, you make that connection obvious and much more explicit than most people think about it. I think both in Synthetic Messenger, as well as in most recent Solar Protocol, there's an element of making it obvious how much digital technology actually contributes to climate change itself, but also to our perception of climate change. Maybe you want to expand on this a little bit.
Yeah, so I think you've like sort of identified the two threads, right? The first is that, yeah, the cloud, our computational infrastructures are massively energy intensive, that, you know, there's estimates now that like the cloud and, you know, the data centers that run all the digital services we rely on, their carbon footprint is more than the aviation industry. So it's significant. Like, I don't think there's enough attention and scrutiny on this, particularly like post-pandemic where, you know, we all just jumped onto Zoom and streaming and like quite intensive online services pretty much because we had to, but like, again, not thinking about the material consequences for this. And there are there's a lot of reporting and controversy around like where data centers are getting built. And I'm sure, you know, you've heard some of these issues pop up where, like, you know, they're now competing with agriculture and human communities for water and so on. So it's
Bitcoin farms as well.
Yeah, Bitcoin farms as well.
We should just give all the water to the computer.
that's great. Yeah,
that seems to be what Silicon Valley wants. So there's that aspect of it, right? And my work, Solar Protocol, which is a sort of big community project, collaboration with a number of other artists and designers in New York. Yeah, looks at this. So it's a project that attempts to build a solar powered hosting service. So we used solar powered servers and we've sent servers out to different volunteers around the world and they are all sort of connected and you're able to host websites on it. But the sort of you know, the twist or the experiment in the project is that the platform and the content that the system serves gets served from whichever server is in the most sunshine. So it's also an experiment in automation around, like, we don't have to automate things necessarily with machine learning systems or historic data sets. You know, it is possible to automate things and use the sort of agency of the environment to make decisions about how our infrastructure operates. And so in this case, by having the sort of serving computer be positioned to wherever is the most sun, you're also then positioning the computational work that's required to create the website wherever there's the most energy at the time. So it's a sort of really interesting experiment in, you know, I guess sort of bespoke planetary computing, right? We have a server in Kenya, a few in the US, Canada, you know, in different places. That's a project that I've been working on for the last few years. We recently put together our first sort of like online exhibition on the platform. And we're really thinking of it as sort of community-run, solar-powered artist space, right? What does it look like to try to build your own stack? It's very much about the sort of social relationships and network you have as it is about the technical.
What inspired me especially is I love the manifesto on the website. I think it's beautifully written and it highlights a lot of important points. And I think this is one point you make where basically by creating this project and showing how, you know, websites can be built differently and depending on the solar cycle and so on, the process of making a website is incentivized on something else. Because normally when you make a website, nobody usually thinks about the amount of data that's being put on, the amount of the size of the files, because we're constantly being told that data is actually free and, or like server costs are so low and copy pasting data anywhere is basically not an effort. And suddenly through this project, you make it very clear that it takes a lot of energy to do that. So it's not at all energy efficient. And I think you open up this new paradigm of thinking about technology of what if we create it in collaboration with the natural cycles and with natural technology versus this artificial technology that we created where nobody really thinks about the impact on the climate.
Yeah, you know, it's also a provocation to, yeah, what does it look like if we try to design within or closer to planetary limits? You know, when you're working with solar and you've used all the energy in the battery, like everything goes down, you have to go and do something else. So how can thinking about working within these limits also be like, you know, creatively productive? So thinking about, you know, how we might design differently or develop different aesthetics based on these different parameters, rather than this imagination for infinite computing, which still is very prevalent, right? As you mentioned, seamless design, a lot of the work of UX over the last decade has been to make us forget all the sort of material and social costs involved in digital technologies. So that project has been a real learning curve and I think very generative for thinking about this and having this conversation.
Sam, do you want to talk about the other project you worked on, I think, in 2021, Synthetic Messenger, which is also somehow related to that topic, I think.
Yeah, sure. So Tika and I started like doing these projects that we, in a kind of like series that we've been calling Expanded Geoengineering. And the notion here is to sort of take a kind of like a weirder approach to what climate engineering could look like, right? And to think about, again, to kind of respond to the way in which, I guess you could say sort of like status quo attempts to like keep that status quo going by, instead of changing kind of like modes of production, we're just going to try to suck carbon out of the air or do the most like convoluted possible technological processes and to produce like solutions, right? With Synthetic Messenger, we were looking specifically at kind of like the relationship between media and the way that media is shaped by algorithms and the way that that goes on to affect ecology and climate. We were noticing that, you know, particularly in like a US context, you know, you look at the newspaper every day, right? And they're like this, there's constant climate catastrophe, but like that, those things are not like necessarily being covered. Obviously, we all know like existential risk that's happening, but these risks are frequently not like above the fold, right? As you say, like they're not like at the top of the newspaper, right? And so like, why is that the case? One reason that might be the case is that like covering these like really sort of dire stories, right? Like they don't get the same kind of engagement that like other kinds of news gets, right? This maybe has more spectacle to it.
Yeah, and engagement translates into money being made by the newspaper publishers.
That's right. And like what engagement means online right now is like a, is like not just someone saying, this is the thing that matters to us. This is what we should be pushing, right? These are the stories we want to tell. That's being like really influenced by algorithmic decision making and like virtual signals of engagement. So like clicks and likes and shares and scrolls and all the stuff that kind of goes into understanding understanding how the web is used via data. So that's kind of like one piece of it. And the other piece of it was that at the time there was a lot of concern around bots, right? And specifically there were kind of like narratives around how, you know, automated systems were being used to kind of fake human engagement, right? And to do anti-democratic things. For us, we were interested in thinking about like, is there like kind of two things, like, you know, how can we kind of investigate the way that media landscapes are being shaped algorithmically and ignoring climate change? And also how can we kind of like look at and leverage this use of bots? And so we're attempting to combine those things. And what we did is we made a system, like a botnet. And the botnet, the way that it works is it every day looks for articles on a variety of news websites about climate change. And then it sends out these little autonomous agents. They visit those articles and they click on the ads that run alongside the articles. So, you know, when you click on an ad on a website, like you're actually transferring some money from the ad network to the website that's hosting the ad, right? And so our goal here was to kind of create artificial engagement data that would both make it look like these articles were being visited more frequently than they actually were, and also literally provide a financial incentive to these news outlets, right? So it's this sort of dual purpose. And unlike the kind of right-wing botnets that we were seeing, our botnet isn't talking to humans. It's talking to other automated systems. So it's like an automated system that's talking to another automated system. It was during the pandemic that we did this project, one of many kind of like pandemic projects. So there was supposed to be some kind of like physical outcome, right? Installation or otherwise, right? But it all went online. And so we took this project and turned it into a Zoom performance. Okay. So you would join this like Zoom room, and then all the bots would join, also like 100 bots as like individual avatars. And you could watch them.
Wow.
You could watch them kind of go around the web and click on different ads, right?
And was it merely an artistic intervention, or did it actually result in more people seeing these climate change articles because of the bot activity?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question, and there's no way for us to know.
Yeah, right? Okay.
So like, it's like one of those things that's like total hypothetical, right? If we were the news outlets seeing the bot activity in our data, right, in our Google Analytics or something, you might be able to say, right, you could do a control. But like, because we were just doing it kind of in a black box in a way, into the void in a way, it's very hard for us to know.
Yeah, and I mean, this is one of the issues with the digital advertising business model of the internet is, are these systems are really opaque, really hard to audit, and the sort of ad networks out there don't give you a lot of the data that would help you understand that question of like, what does it actually do? So, I mean, that's part of this project for us is like, asking that question of what does it mean that we've got so much riding on these digital ad systems, right? Like the stock prices of all the big tech companies out there are based on this system being legitimate and working, and yet it's fairly opaque and very difficult to audit. And people like Tim Huang have been writing about this. He wrote that book, Subprime Attention Crisis, which is like diving into the opacity of this system.
Also just like one of the many, many consequences of having an ad-driven internet.
That is opaque.
Yeah. And just having the whole thing being run by ads, right? I think it creates a series of crises. One of them is involving the news media.
So do you think another internet is possible that's not ad-driven?
Yeah, definitely. Of course. I mean, it's like, do you think libraries are possible? It's like, yes, of course, right? Do you think the post office is possible? Yes, you know, like, of course, these things are all possible. One of the things I love about Solar Protocol is like, that's it's like an actual attempt to do something like that, right? I think that it's just... slow and difficult and perhaps less convenient also, right? Because all the resources are in these ad platforms, right? It's quite challenging. Like we use like a mesh network for our internet. It's a community project, right? Where basically like the roofs of different buildings have these like Wi-Fi, they're shooting like radio to each other to create this network. And, you know, it's a community project. It's free. It's amazing. And also, if it rains hard, the internet goes down.
Okay. Ah. So you are not on the internet when it rains in
Brooklyn? Has to rain pretty hard. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, but sometimes it goes, okay. It's less reliable. You know, it's the community-driven projects, you know, they're amazing. And they're sometimes less reliable or less convenient. And there's trade-offs and that's okay, you know.
I think I recently came across this study or this graph, I think shared by some VC on the internet, where it looked at tech innovation over the last 3 or 4 decades measured by convenience. And I think that's a very interesting lens to take on technology and innovation, because you realize whenever something makes something more convenient, it usually gets mass adoption. I mean, Amazon making the online shopping experience one click less and more convenient resulted in huge spikes. So I think convenience is a very interesting measurement to look at of like why technology is so all-encompassing in our lives. I wanted to ask you, it's 2023, and last week at the panel in Vienna, Tiga, during the panel discussion, you mentioned you feel massive climate anxiety. I think a lot of us do, but also we feel very helpless often, and that helplessness, I think, is this year being translated into people gluing themselves on the streets and you know, several activist groups making radical choices to make people more aware. So I wondered, when it comes to your work, do you see yourself in a context of climate activism, or is it something else that you want, you know, to convey through your work and to reach people in a certain way?
I mean, I think there's definitely an activist thread in all the projects I do. You know, I think for me, Solar Protocol is also an advocacy project around like, why aren't we doing these creative experiments with solar? Like, how do we get the sort of artistic community on board with the energy transition that we have to be urgently doing? It's a massive cultural project as well as being a technical one, right? I think artists and, you know, culture workers and institutions have a really central role to play in getting that transition and going. So I think, yeah, the work that I do and that we both do has that activist agenda as well. And I mean, lately, I guess we have done a series of projects like the Synthetic Messenger one about like looking at where are these sort of opportunities for leverage in our technological systems for, you know, more positive climate outcomes. But that also can start to feel like, I don't know, I think we also have been like, well, there's sort of limitations on what you can achieve there. And so one project we did just in 2022, which I guess it was a response to this, like, where are these leverage points and are we doing enough, is we got a sort of grant from NYU, and rather than making a work, we just redistributed it, gave honorariums to different climate activists who had been incarcerated, and we just asked them for an interview. And that project is called Fragile States, and we spoke to a handful of really inspiring, amazing people who were really, you know, suffering the consequences of the way that states and police and legal systems are cracking down on climate activism in a really aggressive way. This is happening in Australia. This is happening in the US. I think it's happening throughout Europe as well. At the same time as we're in this crisis, we're in this urgent situation, we all feel this anxiety, the state is responding with this sort of aggressive escalation of like consequences for protest, which I think is extremely concerning and worrying. So yeah, we were trying to shine a light on that and just also hear about the experiences of these folks who, you know, have been sort of dealing with the real pointy end of the law in response to the activism work they've been doing. To build on that, what we're researching this year is looking at carbon accounting and carbon offsets, so the sort of emerging carbon markets, where we are doing a sort of ongoing project is something that we're trying to take a bit slower and spend some more time researching. But looking at, you know, is there a way that sort of direct action and industrial sabotage and protest could be understood as having carbon benefits. So like, how might you quantify someone shutting down a coal port for 2 weeks? And is there a way that that could be recognized like financially, and that and money could be distributed to the activists who are actually doing that work? So that's the sort of provocation. And I think the provocation there is also thinking about how, you know, the idea of carbon accounting is that we need to quantify the carbon cycle and, you know, give it, put a price on that. And so that means that like actions that might be traditionally considered illegal, like what is the, what, how does that play into sort of a world of quantified carbon? So yeah, we're sort of working on that at the moment.
If you find out that this is true, that would mean there would be a case for more activists could justify themselves, even in a legal system, maybe why this is important, because it actually saves the planet. I mean, obviously it saves the planet, but there's now a measurement to it.
I think that like the reason that carbon offsets have even been a little bit successful is because they are completely legible to finance, right? You know, they're legible to capitalism, they're legible to like large corporations, right? And so I think that, you know, for us, it's interesting to think of a way of framing sabotage as a form of carbon offsetting, right? To make it like legible and to sort of take the notion that carbon accounting puts forward, right? And just take that to its kind of like logical extreme. So at the moment, we're kind of developing these different methodologies for how you could take some kind of action, some kind of act of sabotage and convert that into carbon, right? We're very strictly holding ourselves to kind of the standards of the carbon offsetting industry. We're not doing anything that's like outside of what regular carbon accounting does. It can be quite convoluted how carbon accounting, you know, takes X number of trees that you didn't cut down for a year and then turns that into a saleable asset. But so we're not doing anything outside of what they would do, right?
And so you're taking the logic that is established within the financial system.
That's right. Yeah. And it's really amazing to look into carbon offsets because like there's some pretty weird stuff out there, right? So for example, there's a notion of temporary carbon storage, right? So let's say that you have a forest and you're like, "Well, I'm just not going to cut down this forest for a year." Okay, great. So you can actually sell the not cutting down of the forest for just 1 year as a carbon offset.
Okay.
And that's called temporary carbon storage. You're using the forest as a way to store carbon temporarily.
I'm staking the forest, basically.
Yeah, exactly. In theory, perhaps it's better to wait a year to cut it down. Perhaps, right? And so we've realized that certain forms of industrial sabotage are doing the same thing. So if you, for example, let's say there's a port in Australia that does most of the coal exports, right? All the coal is moving through there, right? So if you shut down that port for a week, you're effectively storing carbon at the site of the port. You're doing the same thing as not cutting down the forest, right? We can turn that, we can calculate those numbers, right? And we can turn it into a carbon offset.
I love that.
These methodologies, as you might have guessed, are like massively problematic. And is sort of growing critical voices around, like, I think the gap between these theoretical methods that are coming out of finance and then like actually what's happening in terms of like material flows and ecosystems and ecology, right? This is really what we need to be looking at the moment, which is, you know, we have this assumption that like if there's something has a monetary value, or if the government says, "Oh, I'm, you know, putting X billion dollars into climate change," that actually translates into better carbon outcomes. And at the moment, we are not in a situation where that is true, right? And so there's a huge gap there. And I think what we're trying to do is like provide pathways into this conversation and like how to like what let's actually look at these methodologies and what claims are being made, because the industry is pretty nascent. Carbon markets are still very much like emerging and not well regulated. And, you know, you probably see all the stories about bad carbon offsets in the papers because there's many of them. So I think, you know, we're at a stage where really like this stuff really needs to be discussed, and it needs to be much better public awareness and sort of literacy around what the industry is doing.
My final question would be, all of that is of course very bleak and depressing, or can be very bleak and depressing. we're not on a good track with climate change and the climate crisis, I'd say. What gives you hope?
What gives me hope is these systems that we're building are all just based on people making decisions, right? They're not set in stone. You point out the public library example, and I think it's really important to remember that there are so many other ways we can build the world and manage these things. I think we're trying to create an imagination and remind people that this is the case is really important work. Through the sort of work we've been doing in the Offset project and looking at like the work of activists too, that also really gives me hope. The wins, particularly by Indigenous-driven activism in the US, has provided massive carbon savings. Like if you actually look at it in terms of quantity of carbon prevented from entering the atmosphere through like, you know, coal-fired power stations being blocked, that's been way more effective than market-driven solutions. Like, so rather than the offsetting and the turning everything into a carbon market. And so the wins by activists, even though, you know, we've got obviously got so far to go and we've got to do it fast, but that is really inspiring to me.
What about you, Sam?
Well, I like the Kafka quote, that hope exists, but not for us.
Oh, wow. That sounds bleak.
No, but I think, so just to echo Tiga, I think that the work that organizers are doing is like extremely, it's of course very inspirational. And the other thing is, you know, we've talked about this a lot, you and I, Tiga, like how the sort of some of the state responses to climate activism, climate organizing have been so extreme. Right? The taking something that was once maybe a minor public disturbance and describing it or framing it legally as terrorism, right? These attempts to really criminalize organizing, right? They also speak, as bad as they are, they also speak to like the effectiveness of those actions. The government wouldn't be responding like that if those actions weren't effective. Right. And so I think that it's really important to bear that in mind. Also to realize that these struggles are not individual. They're not operating in a void. They're connected to each other. They have histories to them and legacies to them and threads that go to other struggles. And there's a lot of solace, I think, that we can all take in that.
Beautiful. Thank you.
I guess just the one other thing we didn't mention, just going back to Offset just for a second, is I think that project is also very much about like what is an appropriate legal system at this moment of like ecological collapse and climate emergency. We're speaking to a lot of lawyers at the moment about the situation, right? With in terms of like how climate activists are being cracked down on and so on. And I think, you know, the legal system is designed to defend the status quo, right? And maintain the status quo. But the status quo is killing us. What to do then, right? Like we have all of these systems, the legal system, you could argue our computational infrastructure, like all these systems are sort of grounded in assumptions that come out of the Holocene, right? This sort of like era that has passed. I think we need across the board to shift into this new era that we're in, which is one where we need to be thinking about regeneration and limits and like designing in different ways and sort of defining success in different ways.
It's just capitalism. So, we have to, unfortunately, get rid of that one too, if we're expecting to be around in 100 years.
All right. Thank you.
That was Tiga Brain and Sam Levine. If you also want to end capitalism forever or just check out more of their work, visit tigabrain.com and laugh.io and say hi. And if you're interested in the relationship between technology and ecology, I also recommend listening to our previous episode with James Bridle, where we discuss this topic in further detail. This is the Culture and Technology Podcast, produced by the Vienna Business Agency. The Vienna Business Agency supports new companies, projects, and products that develop Vienna's creative industries further.